Spirit Radio Podcasts.
Now, the latest reports from a national student housing survey has shown that 78% of students are worried about their ability to pay rent this coming semester. There's also unresolved issues surrounding student accommodation rent, where half of students did not have their deposits returned when they were forced to leave their rented accommodation at the start of lockdown in March. And on the line to tell us more, I have John Mark McCafferty, CEO of Threshold, the national housing charity. You're very welcome to the show, John Mark. How are you?
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
So, first of all, John Mark, we might just start with sort of the hangover from last year, last academic year, and the lockdown back in March. What have you found there?
Yes, well, I mean, there was a number of things there in relation to the lockdown, because it had very substantial impact on renters and especially on students. It was a very kind of uncertain time for them.
So effectively, most students went home, isn't that right? You know, at short notice and finished the year at home. And some were still paying rent, or some didn't get their deposits back. Is that what happened?
Yeah, I guess when universities closed and exams were cancelled, many students were forced to move out of their accommodation with little opportunity to retrieve their belongings even. Many renters, private renters, are in precarious situations anyway, and for many students, they're even in more precarious situations because they tend to rent for shorter periods. They're younger; they're probably less au fait with the very complex rental laws and their entitlements and their rights. So we thought it was fitting to work alongside Union of Students of Ireland and do a piece of research. So we surveyed 150 people. So it gives a kind of a taste. So it gives a snapshot and an indication as to the experience of students who are renting or who are trying to rent. And what we found that over three quarters of those who responded were worried about their ability to pay rent. The experience of those surveys was that 45% had been asked for over 1 month's rent and deposit. So usually, obviously, when you start a tenancy, you'll be paying your 1 month's rent in advance, generally, and then you'll be paying a deposit, which is usually equivalent to 1 month's rent. But they found and they reported that they were being asked to pay a deposit which was higher than that, maybe a multiple of months. And indeed, just over one-fifth, 21%, had reported that they'd been asked to pay 4 months' rent in advance, in addition to whatever they were paying in a deposit. So, as we know, tenants, students who rent are not a high-income group, often landlords are looking for large sums in advance for students to secure those properties. And of course, given the private rented sector, the lack of supply, the lack of affordable private rented housing, students are quite desperate, and students' families, parents of students, are often desperate to try and secure accommodation at this time of the year, August, September. What we also found was that essentially a half didn't have the rental deposits refunded at the end of a period, and that was an issue at times lockdown, where when students were leaving, they weren't getting their deposit back. And, 49% of the cases reported here in the survey. Now, obviously, it's not a survey of thousands of students, but 150 does give you a good indication, a good taster of the experience that is common and shared by many students who have been renting across Ireland over the last months and years.
Yeah, well, like it is such an uncertain time. But of course, for young people going to college, particularly for the first time, but even any year, that really sort of getting your accommodation sorted is so important. It's such a big concern for parents, that they're that their children get sorted in an environment that's going to be good for them, that's going to be secure for them. So it really is such an uncertain time. Is there a place where people can go and find out, get advice, and maybe get informed on their rights and what they should be looking for when seeking accommodation?
Absolutely. I mean, the place for private renters generally is Thresholds. We are the only charity specialising in advising private rented tenants. We've been set up over 40 years ago to assist and advise tenants, and indeed to represent tenants in places like the Residential Tenancies Board. And one of the group of tenants that are particularly vulnerable are students who rent. So our number is 1800 454 454. That's 1800 454 454. Students and people more generally can come to our website. That's threshold.ie. We have a web chat service, and also people can connect with their local office. We have offices in Dublin, Cork, and Galway. And while we're still given the restrictions, we're not meeting people face to face. We are providing our free confidential nationwide telephone service of 1800 454 454. We are responding to queries and providing advice to students and renters, wider renters alike, on threshold.ie. And also people can link in and navigate the site, and they'll find a place where they can leave their details if they don't want to use the web chat. Yeah. They can also leave information there. I'd also signpost people to their student union, whether that's the USI generally or the student union in their college or university. But I can't emphasise enough, Steve, that we are there to provide advice and support for private renters in general and student renters in particular, in terms of the ever-changing rental laws, the complex tenancy legislation that we have on the rights and responsibility of private renters. And we're there to represent tenants across the country. Well, we already have issues with their tenancy.
Yeah. Well, a couple of specific questions, John Mark. One is the deposit protection scheme. Can you tell us what this is, and could this be of more help to students, particularly at this sort of uncertain time where deposits are being sought and maybe longer deposits than normal?
One of the common issues that comes to the Residential Tenancies Board and where there are disputes is the retention of deposits by landlords, and that is often contested by private renters. Students and tenants alike often complain that when they leave a tenancy and they have justifiable right to have their tenancy or their deposits returned to them, the landlord withholds it and doesn't give it back. And that can be a sizable amount of money. It could be, you know, 1,500, 2,000, in excess of 2,000 euro of a deposit. And that's a real issue for most people. That's a big chunk of change and would assist someone in finding another place. So we don't have a system in place in Ireland for independently verifying the merits of withholding a deposit or not. They go to a dispute mechanism, and it's a drawn-out process at the Residential Tenancies Board. With a deposit protection scheme, it would hold the deposit with a third party, an objective third party, who would then release the deposit to either the landlord or the tenant, depending on the nature of the of how the tenancy has gone, how the property has been cared for or otherwise. And, you know, in the vast majority of situations, tenants leave a property in good working order, and yet for such a proportion of tenancies, many deposits are retained by landlords, and these are challenged. And if we had a deposit protection scheme, that would ensure that deposits, there's a higher likelihood of deposits being returned without tenants having to go through a long drawn out process, often where they don't receive their deposit returns. So that, I think it's really important that a scheme is implemented. There is legislation from 2015. I guess the issue is there, while it has been enacted, it hasn't commenced. So it's not being practiced. It's not available. So maybe landlords or tenants.
So maybe that's an issue that people can take up with their local public representative to actually to accelerate that. Just one, maybe one, I could talk to you about this for hours, John Mark, because it's such an important area, and maybe we'll have you back later in the year. But just the thing of, like, we have such uncertainty right today. You know, talk about, you know, further restrictions in Dublin different to the rest of Ireland. So we've got this situation where college students are facing into a year that may be a real hybrid of sort of going to lectures and things like that, or online learning, and then maybe some are on courses that are more conducive to online learning than others, which may require, say, a term of, you know, medical placements or things like that. So with this sort of hybrid that people are possibly going to be renting accommodation that then they can't use or they won't be using all of the time, do you have any advice on how to negotiate such rental arrangements?
Yeah, it's really difficult, and it's difficult for both tenants and landlords.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, it's very uncertain time for landlords as well, especially a landlord that has maybe just one property, and you know they've been used to that very regular income of, you know, a group of tenants, a group of students living in their place maybe for, you know, 7 or 8 months of the year, and then they might have holiday lets then in the summer. And I guess with COVID-19, all of that certainty has gone. And we're all trying to find our feet. I mean, I suppose what we're looking for from the larger institutions that are letting to students, the purpose-built student accommodation, the colleges themselves, and the other players that are providing accommodation en masse, like, they have the scale and they have the oversight to provide more time-bound offerings for students if, you know, a student knows they're going to be needed in around the campus and in college and at university for certain times of the year, certain weeks. There should be that flexibility built into the offering by the larger providers. It's more difficult for smaller landlords, and the vast majority of people who are in the private rented sector, they're living in a home which is maybe owned by a landlord which only has that rented accommodation, and they maybe only have one or two properties. So that is much more challenging. And I know there has been a growing trend of students commuting from home and commuting maybe long distances every day to university anyway because of the lack of availability of accommodation and because of the lack of affordable accommodation, and there will probably be more of that as you find students working from home and then maybe going into college, but commuting, that's not so easy if you live in, say, Letterkenny and your college or university is in Dublin or Cork or Wexford. So it's a real uncertain time. The best thing to do is to contact our advisors on 1800 454 454. And also to contact the students' union in their college and or their university.
Yeah, well, I think that is the key message I'm taking away from this. And I have a son starting college for the first time. You know, the key message is to seek advice. It's a very uncertain time. Go to the experts who can give advice on what's happening. So, John Mark McCafferty, CEO of Threshold, the National Housing Charity, thank you so much for talking to us this morning, and I'm sure we'll be talking to you again. So the website again is www.threshold.ie, and the phone number to call is 1-800-454-454. Spirit. Well, we all want every human being to live every part of their life with dignity. And of course, at certain stages of a person's life, particularly when they're most vulnerable, there's a special need for society as a whole to get behind supporting and affirming that person's dignity. Now, there's a bill coming before the Dáil tomorrow which uses the word dignity. It's called the Dying with Dignity Bill, and it would permit assisted suicide for people with a terminal illness. So is assisted suicide needed as part of the range of treatments available to doctors and caring for patients and treating them with dignity? That's a question for my next guest. He's Professor in Medical Gerontology in Trinity College Dublin and its campus at Talley University Hospital. Professor Des O'Neill, you're very welcome to Spirit Radio.
Thank you very much indeed. My first time on Spirit.
Oh, great. Oh, well, hopefully not the last. So, Professor O'Neill, first of all, is dignity currently at the core of how our health system care for patients?
Yes, I mean, I think there is a bit of concern about effectively the hijacking or subverting of the use of the word dignity here in association with a really marginal or concerning area of practice. So dignity is very much at the heart of what we try to do. Obviously, people dealing with people, there are always challenges. But, you know, dignity is something that's inherent to us. It's something the German Constitution, after all the experiences they've had, they've talked about that human dignity is untouchable. So it really is important that the public are reassured that all we do when geriatric medicine, palliative care, is our aim is not only to deal with dignity, but also to help people deal with uncertainty. And I think at the heart of this bill, which we would feel really is misguided, is a lack of understanding or misinterpretation of areas of concern around suffering in the future and areas of concern over dignified treatment. So our dignity is untouchable, but the key issue is dignified treatment. And I think the dangers here are very clear. I mean, at least it's not as if we don't know what's happening in other countries. And inevitably, this movement towards, instead of having a therapeutic and diagnostic and supportive approach, instead of one which goes for death, hastening death, is really problematic. And for the general public, I would direct them towards, many of them will have seen Clint Eastwood's Million Dollar Baby. Well, at the end of it, Clint puts a pillow over Hilary Swank, who's been very disabled following a boxing match. And there seems to be a tolerance or a sense that this was merciful. But we as doctors looked on with horror at this because, first of all, she had pressure sores. You shouldn't have pressure sores in modern care. Secondly, she had an infected leg, which led to an amputation. I have never seen or heard of that. This would be the worst of worst care. Thirdly, she clearly had a significant depression, and what she needed was treatment to that depression. And finally, the environment was fairly awful, and now you can nearly always take and bring people out, bring in music, do things with people. So what happened, and the kind of assent or support for what seemed to be merciful actually hid a double tragedy. First of all, the response to that patient's poor care was not to write it, but to kill her. And the second thing was, it meant that the origin of this suffering, the poor care, was not addressed. And where Clint Eastwood, as the actor there, may have felt better or for his guilt at having put her into that place, this film neatly captures why this is the wrong way to go. And one of the things that, again, there's a wealth of literature here that we would like to help the public with. I was part of a working group with the College of Physicians, which included geriatric medicine and palliative care and psychiatry, and the council there has passed a document outlining why this is not a good idea. And one of the things we know from medicine is very often ahead of something like terminal care or stroke or whatever else, people say, "Ooh, I, that's awful, I'd rather die than have it." And then when they get to that point, they very much change their mind.
Well, maybe just let's take up just one person who has said, who's come out in support of this bill and said that she would like the choice. It's Vicky Phelan, who has a terminal illness and obviously was in the news because of the poor care that I suppose that she'd received in the cancer screening. So she said, "I've seen people in recent years with a certain amount of suffering that no pain management can get on top of. I don't want my children to see me like that. All I'm asking for is a choice." So what? How would you respond to someone like Vicky Phelan who speaks in this sort of way?
Yeah, well, first of all, it's obviously clearly very difficult, and I don't know what discussions, if any, for example, she has had with the palliative care services in her area, and certainly if she hasn't, I would urge her to have these discussions. I'm in practice now for 35 years, and I have not seen the scenarios she's outlined. I deal with general medicine, I deal with stroke, I deal with patients with cancer. We're fortunate to have good palliative care services here. And the other thing is, there's an interesting area in the literature around choices of people who actually have the condition and those who witness it and their families. And indeed, palliative care physicians have written eloquently about the challenge that the patient themselves, the person themselves, may wish, for example, to choose over pain control, because virtually always pain can be controlled, but you may be more sedated by it. But they wanted more clarity in their mind and they wanted more time. But this was distressing to their family and onlookers. So it really is very complex dealing with this. And I suppose we would ask, I think the danger sometimes is that palliative care might get called in too late. So I think people, you know, if one has fears around how one's death is going to be, the thing to do is get information. So as I said, I obviously don't have the details in this case here. But also, I think we have to be mindful, and there's very interesting conversations around, for example, autonomy and what I want, around the anti-vaxxers, for example. The people who say, well, you know, it's my autonomy, it's my right, I don't want to have the vaccine. And yet we as a society have a very important interest in both protecting their children and also in protecting society. And I think it's around when engaging with people, whether it's from whichever of these areas here around autonomy, is first of all is to accept their sincerity and motivations as honest. Secondly, to deal with it around reassurance, around compassion, but also accepting there's always going to be a degree of uncertainty. But I think the last thing is we need more debate around autonomy. Autonomy is clearly important, and as doctors, we're always trying to both support patients and help them with autonomy. But autonomy has its limits. We are relational societal beings. So, for example, you can't smoke in a bar in Ireland. You can't ride a motorbike without a helmet. You can't drive a car without a seatbelt. So, we talk of no smoking in cars with children. So, our autonomy for what we want to do, everything has implications. And it's really clear to us, particularly from a case in the Netherlands recently, this case where the lady with dementia who thought she wanted euthanasia later on in life clearly signaled to us who know dementia care that she didn't want it. And they sedated her without her knowledge and restrained her and gave her euthanasia. And what the implications of allowing this act in is around the erosion of a positive, supportive, therapeutic, positive response.
Yeah, well, just on that, Professor O'Neill, you're involved with the Alzheimer's Society of Ireland as the first medical director, and I assume Alzheimer's would be counted in this bill, you know, under their kind of broad term of terminal illness. How would the legal availability of euthanasia in this bill affect the care of people with dementia?
I think in the longer term, this has very toxic effects. And indeed, it's very interesting around the discourse around the legalization, the permission of assisted suicide in Germany, where, you know, one of the key palliative care people involved talked about, like, the commonest reason for people wanting this in the countries where it is permitted is around them feeling a burden. And, you know, surely our mission is to make them feel that they're not a burden and provide that environment. I've certainly been on to the Alzheimer's Society to say that I hope that they will add their voice to this debate. I think the proponents sometimes point to the fact, well, there's, you know, that it's predominantly later middle age, early old age, but that avail of it directly, but it's the indirect and knock-on effects, and now we're beginning to see direct effects as well. And it's creating this sense that rather than trying to tackle and improve care, well, there comes a point, well, you know, well, actually, there's a kind of a, we'll abbreviate it, we'll foreclose early. It's a sense of foreclosing early on human and societal potential.
Yeah, no, thank you very much for coming on the air to talk about this bill. And I'm sure there's so many angles that we could talk about. You've said that there's a need for debate in this area. But maybe for just my final question, are you concerned that this bill will pass? Because my impression is that there actually hasn't been a lot of debate, but do you think that this could pass tomorrow?
Yeah, I suppose there must be. Well, I think it's introduced and then it's debated.
Yeah.
I think there are concerns. My real concern is that the debate hasn't been picked up from the point of view, particularly of the physicians who have expressed an interest. That it has been, perhaps it has been oversimplistic, and I think also potentially. I very much appreciate the time you and Mick Clifford, for example, have given here. I think thankfully, we're trying to hope that the media avoid the temptation of painting it as kind of an adversarial, liberal versus conservative, or religious versus secular. So I think there really hasn't been a chance to hear, I think, the concerns of those from the other sides. And the danger sometimes around social legislation of this kind is that it doesn't appear to have a financial impact. It has the appearance of action, of doing something. And I just hope that there's enough prudence, common sense and wisdom for people to say, look, there's needs and concerns been raised here, let's address them, but let's not let dignity be kidnapped by a single narrow trope. Let's let dignity be a broad thing that we all subscribe to.
Des O'Neill, Professor in Medical Gerontology in Trinity College Dublin and its campus at Tala University Hospital. Thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you, a pleasure. Spirit.
The devastating explosion in Beirut last month was the latest in a series of crises for the people of Lebanon in the midst of surging COVID cases and a severe economic slump. Our next guest has an update from her partners on the ground in Beirut. On the line to tell us more, I have Tear Fund's communications manager, Niamh Daly. You're very welcome to the show, Niamh.
Thank you, Steve. Good morning to you.
So this is, I suppose, one of the great things about Tear Fund. You have partners on the ground. And in fact, we did a couple of months ago, we did an interview with Father William Stewart, who does some work with refugee children in Lebanon. And he said for him, the big story of the pandemic was that where were the NGOs? That so many of the NGOs kind of disappeared from on the ground and were working remotely and things like that. But thankfully, Tear Fund works with partners on the ground. What are you hearing from them about the situation in Beirut at the moment?
Yeah, so our partners, as you say, are locally based. They live and, you know, they're Lebanese. They're part of the life and community there. So they're very much in tune with what's going on. And, you know, our longer than before the explosion, our focus is really on Lebanon because it's carrying more than any other country in terms of Syrian refugees, most of whom are unofficial. So,
huge burden that they were already in showing, I suppose, hospitality to hundreds of thousands, millions of refugees.
Yeah, hundreds of thousands, I think it's 1.2 million, and that's both the registered and the unregistered combined. So a huge percentage of their population. And it would be, you know, it would be a middle-income country, if you like, but just before the pandemic hit, you know, it hit a financial crisis, and for refugees who are living in makeshift accommodation, their basic supplies, you know, quadrupled in cost because of this currency crash that Lebanon experienced. So it was a country definitely on its knees. So, you know, when we heard about the blast there, and we got in touch with our partner, contacted us directly anyway, to tell us what was going on the ground. And some of their buildings were damaged. We had, you know, they were connected with a Christian bookshop, and that had all the glass shattered, and some of the management there, you know, as they spoke to us, they were still plucking out bits of ceiling and dust from their hairs or whatever. But there was no injuries among our partners. But straight away, their focus was to see what they could do to help. And I know I sent you on some great images there of church volunteers out with sweeping brushes, and you know, they're all masked up, and they're just helping clear off the streets in Beirut. And because so many people just lost function in their kitchens and homes, even if they weren't badly damaged, there was a big mobilization to make ready meals. So there's the young people and church volunteers are distributing these ready meals to people around the area where they're based there, which was about 3 kilometers from the blast. You know, our ongoing work there will be after this I'm sure the effects of this explosion will be felt for a very long time, but ultimately our work is focused really on the most vulnerable, who are those refugees and those living in makeshift accommodation as we come into the winter.
I read a lovely quote from a 70-year-old lady that was received some aid. Do you want to mention her?
So she met some of the volunteers on the street, and she had her mask half on, if you like, and she said, you know, I'm 70, I'm the youngest among my two other sisters, we live in a small house here, I can't believe we're still alive, God loves Lebanon, and with all the destruction and force of the blast, we are still breathing, we still see, hear and understand what's going on, I can still walk, although my leg is injured. My other sisters are up there, tired and in pain. I went out to bring some food home. We don't have electricity and water, but they promised to solve that soon. Thank you for being here. You will help Beirut rise again. Young generation is our hope. So
yeah, so it's a real message of both hardship and hope from her. And I was just really touched actually when I saw that. And the fact is that your aid is getting to people in need and is helping the situation, which is wonderful to hear. Now it's probably your work all around the world has been affected by the COVID pandemic, everyone having to operate differently, but a particular country that maybe must be most one of the most extreme situations is Yemen. Have you still been able to help people on the ground there?
Like that as well, because we have a long-term partnership with local partners on the ground, we've been able to direct some support there. And just some good stories. There's a lovely girl called Yana Burrell. Some people might know her. She's living in Dublin. And she's yarning for Yemen at the moment. She's making these gorgeous beanies that you can buy online. And she's raised nearly €700 so far for Yemen. So well done to Yana. And go and buy these beautiful hand-knit beanies to help support Tirfa's work in Yemen if you can. But we've kicked off a project there just last week where we've identified about 100 households. Now, when you go through these case proposals, it'll break your heart even when you go through and see how they try and identify these 100 households. So really, people were identified if they had somebody in their home who officially had been diagnosed with severe malnutrition, if there was a female-headed household, or if there was a nursing mum. So they were the households that were identified as the most vulnerable. And we've been able to do kind of door-to-door awareness, hygiene awareness and training with them around COVID-19 and also cholera, because there was the largest cholera outbreak in Yemen there some time ago. And it's a country that's just so water scarce. I think I said it before, you know, there was something written once that said Yemen might be the first country in the world to actually run out of water, because they're so water deficient, and they really rely on trucks, tankers to come and they bring their buckets and they fill their buckets with water that they need. So in one sense, you know, there is, you know, great development in Yemen, and yet the water issue is really so, so critical for them. So these 100 households will receive this training. They'll also receive a hygiene kit that has soap in it, washing powder, water containers, jerry cans, big water team in it. And then monthly they'll get a food package for their family as well. So we're able to commit to that for 100 families for 3 months. So we're just really grateful for everyone who's supported our Yemen appeal recently. Thank you.
Yeah, Niamh, that's great. And it's great to hear that although problems are overwhelming, that it's not stopping yourselves at Tearfront from just making a start. You know, just have a project, concentrate on that project, identify 100 people and start to help. And hopefully that that this will have effects well beyond those 100 people that you initially work with. And I just really encourage anyone to think that, you know, maybe yes, we're experiencing challenge and hardship, but sometimes a way of actually to overcome hardship and anxiety is to look elsewhere, look outside yourself, and maybe also look to see where the big needs are and see how you can help. Perhaps by making a donation, even if it's a very small donation. Listen, Niamh Daly, Communications Manager at Tearfund Ireland, thank you so much for the update this morning. Great to talk to you, Niamh.
Okay, goodbye now. Thank you.
And if you want any more information on some of those fantastic projects, you can just go to tearfund.ie.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.